Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst said she was, in her words, forced out as a survivor of mental and physical abuse. Abuse by her former husband. And also this week, we learned that she survived sexual assault in college. Joining us to talk about it, Angelina Salcido. She's a reporter for ABC Channel 5, WOIDT News in Des Moines. Angelina, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
We asked you on this program also because you had a chance to talk with the senator as this story was breaking. Before we get to that point, remind our listeners how Senator Ernst was, in her words, forced out as a survivor this week. How did this come about?
So basically, it became, I guess, clear to us as the media that these documents, the affidavits that her and both her ex-husband, Gail Ernst, had written in the court system were unsealed at a point in time. And so someone got a hold of the unsealed documents and ended up running a story with that. And that first story, I guess, took it to all of us knowing that this had happened, and we were able to gain access of those unsealed documents as well, and then they were public record, even though they were sealed afterwards. But I think that that's where Senator Ernst says that she was kind of pushed forward and put into the spotlight because these were unsealed. And to me, yesterday when she was talking to me, it was very clear that both of them actually believed that these documents were sealed, so that they were supposed to be sealed. And she's very, very taken aback and kind of thrown off guard by this whole thing, for sure.
Let's listen to a clip of audio from a video that was taken. You asking a question of Senator Ernst about this news event this week. Do you want to set it up, or should we just listen? You're where?
Sure. So basically, this was kind of towards the end of the interviews that we were doing with her. This was the last question that she was asked, and I was the reporter that asked her that question. And I just basically asked her how she believed this was going to change her personally and change her political career as well.
I have always been a strong proponent of working for those survivors of sexual assault and domestic violence. I had even spent time in college, you know, prior to this incident, working with those survivors as a volunteer at the Assault Care Center. So I've always been very focused on those issues. Understanding now that people will view my work in those areas, not as a senator that is working to support them, but now as somebody who has been in that situation that will be supporting them. But what I want to remind everybody is that I'm still the same person as I was a week ago. The only difference is that you know more about me now than you did a week ago. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Angelina, that is so hard to hear from U.S. Senator.
Yeah.
Joni Ernst,
yeah.
What was the feeling in that room when she shared so much of herself and her hurt from her past?
You know, I don't even think that you can really describe the feeling that we had. First of all, we knew what we were going into, and of course the senator knew herself as well because she was making herself available and she knew what she was going to talk about. And I think that it was hard for each of the reporters that were there to ask her questions that are so intimate and close to her, especially when she's really blindsided by the whole thing. But to hear her get emotional like that, I think politics aside, because I've heard several different comments and gotten several different comments from people, but politics aside, it kind of breaks your heart to hear someone like her that holds such a high role in society break down that way and feel the way that she does. And I would kind of just say I've gotten a lot of comments saying, like, yes, we do believe her, and we are in full support of her, and she's so brave for coming out. And I would kind of echo that myself as well. It's definitely not easy for you to come out, and it's not easy for her to take the time to address the media and address what's coming out because, as she said, she was kind of forced into the spotlight, and she was not ready to share any of her past with the public. They both planned to have a private divorce, and unfortunately that hasn't happened for them.
What are your thoughts on that for her, U.S. Senator, as a public figure, being forced out this way to talk about this very painful part of her past made public through this way? Any further thoughts on that?
I think it's a very tough thing. I think that by her coming out and addressing it herself, though, and being willing to actually talk about it and say, hey, this is a part of my past that now my constituents and just people publicly worldwide know that this happened to me, and I guess for her to kind of understand that that's what's happening to her now, that changes her personally, but I don't think that that changes anything that she's going to continue doing politically. I think that she made that clear to me as well, saying that she's been fighting for sexual abuse survivors and domestic abuse survivors ever since she was in college. And she has just pushed for legislation, whether that be in the military or that be in athletics or that be on college campuses, that can help these survivors. And she's trying to make sure that there is funding for them and making sure that they know that she has their support. So I think that it is definitely a very difficult thing. It's something that many people probably didn't expect from Senator Ernst because mm-hmm. of how highly she holds herself. And we see her kind of as a very strong role model for young women and for young girls. So I understand where that is difficult for her, and it probably is a very difficult thing for her family as well.
Right. And the other dimension here, which we haven't even touched on, the political dimension, mm-hmm. that her domestic problems with her then husband, Gail, coincided with then Republican presidential nominee Donald
yep.
Trump's search for vice president. I think today she's more recently clarified that she had not been offered the position, right?
Yeah, and she said that she chose to withdraw her name. She said that that's just a decision that she made personally because she felt that she should make that decision and because Iowa has always been number one for her, and she feels that she has more work to do as a representative in Washington, D.C. to make sure that Iowa's views are represented correctly. So that was her response yesterday, and that's what she really firmly believes, is that she has more work to do, and she's very proud to represent Iowa up in Washington, D.C.
Angelina, I wonder if any part of your reporting on this or the feedback that you've gotten on this has touched into another dimension, that Joni Ernst was seen as a prime vice presidential candidate, not just for any president, but for this president, a president who has himself many credible sexual misconduct allegations charged from many women against him, and a man who has been recorded on video bragging about sexual assault.
Mm-hmm. I think, and those are some of the comments that I've received. I mean, my tweet didn't expect it to get as much as a response as it did, but it did. And there are a lot of tweets saying, like, I really do believe her and I really do feel for her, but I really don't appreciate some of the decisions that she's made up in D.C. And the fact that she does support our current president, President Trump. But I think I've heard the senator react to comments like that, and her response basically is, you can't just say, I guess, for someone who is a supporter of sexual abuse victims and domestic victims that they should automatically be a Democrat or support the other side. She, I guess, is taking and separating both of those things. She still believes very strongly that she needs to support sexual abuse victims and domestic abuse victims, but I don't think that that will change her politically and what she politically believes.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your reporting here. Angelina Salcido, reporter for ABC Channel 5, WOOI DT News in Des Moines. We appreciate this inside look at this this news event with Senator Ernst this week.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Just a quick note before we move on. We did reach out also to Senator Ernst's office for comment on this topic, and they said they'd like to respectfully decline our invitation at this time. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, the partial government shutdown continues. Day 35, disrupting the lives of 800,000 federal employees and their families. One of those furloughed employees is Elizabeth Dinchel. She's an education specialist and archivist at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch. The library is part of the National Archive and Records Administration. Elizabeth, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Elizabeth, as I mentioned, the 35th day of this historic shutdown, partial government shutdown, which began just before Christmas on December 22nd. And I know you have grave concerns about the historical collection of presidential material at the Herbert Hoover Library. But first, let me ask you about the stresses for you and your family personally. You are the breadwinner in your family, right? And the mother of two teenage daughters. With those responsibilities, what's it been like?
It's stressful. I started working for the government right before the first big shutdown with Obama, and that one lasted like 16 days. And I found myself cleaning everything and then buried on the couch under blankets watching news networks waiting for a reopen. We had just spent all of our money moving to Iowa from Florida. My family was calling me, "Did you make a good decision? Was this the right thing to do?" And I'm like, "Yes, it'll be fine." So this shutdown, I've tried to distance myself from it. I'm not watching the news. I'm trying to stay busy. I'm also an MBA student at the University of Iowa's Tippey Business School. And so I've been buried in my work trying to kind of ignore what's going on because it's very upsetting. There's so many elements to it that make it so awful for me.
What are the most aggravating things about it for you? What are the thoughts that grind away in your head?
Well, for example, I tried calling Senator Ernst's office so I could talk to constituent services about being shut down. And I asked, what was going on and what the senator was doing to try to, get the government reopened. And the person on the phone said, "I'll pass along your message." And I said, "Well, no, that was a question." And they said, "I'll pass along your message." And so I commented on a social media post after that and got a ton of comments that were horrible towards me. Like, "No one's holding a gun to your head. Go get a job. We can't do everything for you." I've had people say, we're worse than welfare recipients. And it's awful because the only thing that I've ever wanted to do was to wait on the American public and to serve in our records and our history and our culture. And so seeing how so many American citizens view us as, government leeches is really awful because we work so hard for them. And knowing that we're somehow viewed as not essential is terrifying. We are the stewards of American history and American culture. And every day we go to work and make sure those collections are safe and available for future generations. And all it takes is one small event to jeopardize those documents and artifacts, a small leak, blinds falling down and light coming into our collections, something falling off a shelf. We went to college for 8 years, some of us 10 years or more, so that we can preserve these artifacts. And we're sitting at home with our hands tied, unable to check on them, unable to serve them. Objects are on a schedule. They're on exhibit. They're conserved. They're resting.
Talk a little bit more about that, because I think most of us, we don't know the job of an archivist here.
Right.
We think, okay, Herbert Hoover had a library with books. He has certain books. He has certain documents.
Right.
I think a lot of us are ignorant, that these need attention to stay in good shape.
Yes.
And so give me a specific document or article that you are worried about at the museum right at this very moment.
Well, so just in our museum, we have, and I'm sure if you've been, you've seen, we have these beautiful embroidered flour sacks from World War I and wonderful clothing from Lew Henry Hoover that are in our permanent exhibition space. And they have to be rotated out every several weeks because exposure to light and exposure to air and not in the collections, it shortens the life of the object. The paper, artifacts, everything. Native Americans have a great saying for this. We're turning back to earth. Everything's turning to dust. So the whole time things are sitting in our collections and in our museums, they're actively degrading down. And that's why we have conservators. That's why we have archivists. And so we have really strict schedules to keep them out of the things that harm them, like light and fluctuating temperatures and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So right now, the things that we normally rotate out every couple of weeks are still in our display cases and nobody's there to tend to them. But in all of the archival facilities across the country, and I should say I'm speaking on behalf of myself, not my agency, they're all sitting there with security and facilities people, but not necessarily the professionals that are monitoring the temperature, the humidity, the light, all of the things that we know that impact the lifespan of artifacts and documents. Mm-hmm. And so it's so important that people are there to be able to be with them. If something were to happen, let's say, you know, the Declaration of Independence has a small leak on it, we can't just buy another Declaration of Independence. That's it. It's gone forever. And I think we're seeing a lot of this impact in our national parks as well. A Joshua Tree had trees cut down. We're not going to be able to grow those back in our lifetime.
Have you had a lot of contact, Elizabeth, sharing your concerns with other federal employees who've been furloughed?
We actually have a little face group. Group we've been talking in, and of course we're all kind of connected through different means, so we've been texting and talking through Facebook and Twitter and other means, and I think that people are just really sad. They're really worried about their workplace. They're really worried about, especially for us researchers who've planned for years to come on research trips, to find out that the doors are closed. They probably bought non-refundable plane tickets to come research in our archives. We're not there. We have no way to contact them, and we're not allowed to contact them.
Mm. Have you, I mean, how much of a challenge has it been for you as the breadwinner in your family with your two daughters to go without a paycheck? And have you, in fact, thought of looking for other employment, temporary employment?
Well, so temporary employment is tricky for federal employees. Under normal circumstances, outside employment has to be approved by our supervisor, the Office of Personnel Management, and our Ethics Department. And so for me, I was already working a second job before the shutdown and was kind of able to grovel and ask for some hours where they could give them. But like, I was offered a contract with a nonprofit that helps children, and I work with them in my professional life. And normally I could ask the Office of Personnel Management, my supervisor in ethics, can I work with them? And they could say yes or no. But because I work with them in my professional capacity, they're considered a prohibited source. And so I'm not allowed to work for them, even though I've been offered a contract. So, and like, I work in a specialized field. I think it would be very hard for me to go in to anywhere really that's looking for employees and beg them to hire me, knowing that I could be recalled back to my other job any day, any minute, tonight.
Well, we wish you all the best. Elizabeth Dinschel, education specialist and archivist at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library in West Branch. Thank you for telling us one perspective on a furloughed federal employee and your concern for the Herbert Hoover Presidential Collection in West Branch. Thank you very much, Elizabeth.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Remember J.D. Scholten, that name, the former minor league baseball player who challenged Republican Representative Steve King in Iowa's 4th District last year? And he came very close, closer, as a matter of fact, than any other Democrat to beating King, something like 3.5 percentage points away. Well, the former Democratic congressional candidate, J.D. Scholten, made an announcement on Wednesday. It was quite a big event. Clay Masters was there. Hi, Clay.
Hello, Ben.
Tell us, what did J.D. announce, and what was this event all about?
Well, the day before, we had a press release that went out that said at 10:15 at the Iowa State Capitol, J.D. Scholten was going to make a big announcement about his future plans. And ever since Scholten came in so close to beating Steve King last year, there's been a lot of speculation about what his future plans would be politically. And when you showed up to the Capitol at 10:15 for that press conference, there was a heavy presence of news cameras that were there. Deidre DeGeer was there, the woman who ran as the Democrat for the Secretary of State. Troy Price, the chair of the Iowa Democratic Party, was there. There were a lot of news cameras, a lot of journalists. There was all this buzz, and J.D. Scholten got up and announced that he was running a nonprofit. He wasn't announcing that he was going to be running for office. He was starting a nonprofit with an entrepreneur from California called Working Hero Iowa. And what this is meant to raise awareness for the earned income tax credit up until the April 15th filing day for your taxes.
We want to create partnerships with groups like AARP and United Way and elected officials and religious groups and other groups who are focused on helping low-income Iowans with their taxes.
And the earned income tax credit is a benefit for working people with low to moderate income. So they're going to be on the road helping people figure out how to take advantage of this.
Mm-hmm. Of course, a lot being seen in this announcement past what he announced. Why this issue, the earned tax income credit?
Well, he says that this is the most effective anti-poverty policy in America. And Joe Sandberg, the entrepreneur I mentioned that he's launching this with, was there, had statistics saying that 53,000 Iowans are eligible for this earned income tax credit, and there's a lot of money that's not being taken advantage of. And so he's going to be hitting the road. J.D. Scholten said he's reaching out to 2020 presidential candidate hopefuls, even if they haven't declared yet, to make appearances with him. Now, us in the press corps, we were curious to know, mm-hmm. are you going to be announcing at some point if you're running for something down the road?
Right.
And here's how he responded to that.
I'm leaving the door open to things. November of 2020 seems pretty darn far away, to me at least.
So like any politician, leaving the door open, not saying he's not going to run down the road.
Right, but when we think about possible matchups, there could be a rematch with Steve King, or it's being talked about against Joni Ernst. Senator Ernst is up for re-election in 2020 as well.
She is, and I think that's mainly why a lot of the speculation was that he was going to be announcing a run for the Senate, because it was out of the 4th District. It was in Des Moines at the State House. And there are a number of names that are floating around as possible contenders to run against Joni Ernst in 2020 on the Democratic side. J.D. Scholten is a name that's thrown out there. Also, former Governor Tom Vilsack is a big name that gets thrown around a lot. Rob Sand, the auditor who just started his job, he won a statewide office up from Northeast Iowa. He now lives in Des Moines. Also, Teresa Greenfield, who ran in the 3rd District Democratic primary, which Cindy Axne went on to win and become the new congresswoman in Iowa's 3rd Congressional District, Teresa Greenfield. So her name's getting thrown out there as a possible contender, as well as former State Senator Rita Hart, who was on the ticket with Fred Hubble running for the governor, lieutenant governor, against Kim Reynolds and Adam Gregg.
One election, barely a few months old, and we're off to the races again. Thanks so much, Clay Masters. I have to mention here, when you talk about J.D. Scholten, I wonder if anybody else that you've run into has sort of mentioned him as Iowa's Beto O'Rourke, a Democrat who almost toppled a Republican considered to be safe, and now has what is seen as a bright future.
There are some, you do sometimes hear people kind of make that comparison. J.D. Scholten, he seemed a little out of place at the Capitol. He couldn't find his speech that he had prepared originally. So he's got some of that, everyday Iowa guy thing going for him.
Clay Masters, thanks so much for the conversation.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
Coming up after a short break, we'll hear an update on that lawsuit. It was filed about a year ago against the University of Iowa by a faith-based student group. We'll talk about that. Also, I'll talk with the superintendent of one of Iowa's school districts in Estherville. They're trying out virtual snow days as a way for kids to keep up on schoolwork from home. Also, Tony Daner will groove us into the weekend. That's after a short break. When your Friday news buzz continues, I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Gravitate Coworking, an entrepreneurial support organization and coworking community with locations in Valley Junction and downtown Des Moines. Learn more at gravitatecoworking.com/IPR. Gravitate Coworking. Work better. Work together.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's been more than a year since a faith-based student group sued the University of Iowa for stripping its campus affiliation. That was an action the UI took based on some controversial leadership requirements. Now the two sides are set to face off next week in U.S. District Court in advance of a jury trial in March. Let's talk about it with Vanessa Miller, higher education reporter with the Gazette, who's been covering this story. Vanessa, hi.
Hi.
Remind us, since it's been a while, why the student group Business Leaders in Christ filed this suit.
Yeah, they registered with the Tippie College of Business as an official group back in 2014, and as part of their leadership requirements, they required people to sort of align with their faith or their Christian beliefs. So a student in November of 2017 complained about that. He was openly gay and had tried to become a leader with the group, and they told him that he could not become a leader if he was acting on his sexual orientation, essentially. And so when he complained, the university deregistered this Business Leaders in Christ group. And so they sued, claiming that they were being discriminated against, in that their sort of free speech rights were being violated.
Mm-hmm. And in being deregistered, they lose out on what?
On access to the campuses, like recruitment fairs, the email list. They get some funding and financial resources from the student government. There are lots of benefits that they receive, plus just the recognition by students who are coming in that want to be a part of a student group. They look to the university-affiliated organizations, and so membership will suffer if they don't have that affiliation.
Mm-hmm. So give us the arguments on each side, because this is really fascinating, Vanessa, I think, is how each party here frames their arguments. Talk about the student group, first of all, Business Leaders in Christ. They say what? The UI violated the U.S. Constitution by deregistering faith-based groups.
Yeah, they say that they have sort of a free speech platform and that they're allowed to affiliate with like-minded students, that that's their freedom to do so. And they cite things like fraternities, sororities, things where they're saying, we only allow women in this group, we only allow men in this group. And then they laid out for the judge lots of other groups on campus that have the same requirements as they do, including, Muslim groups that require leaders to follow that faith. They even like a Korean group that requires students to think positively of the Koreas, or even groups that are all inclusive, requiring students to be inclusive minded and to allow everybody on campus. They're saying you can't just kick us out because we're not sort of politically correct to keep on campus, but let everybody else say that they want to affiliate with like minded students. Now the university on the other side says that each student group has to have their human rights policy in their constitution, and they cannot have anything in their student group constitution that discriminates or blocks a student from participating in any way based on the fact that they're in a protected class. And so the university is saying that none of these student groups are allowed to do this. And so a judge pointed out to the university that they were not evenly enforcing their human rights policy. And the university conceded and went back and reviewed all of their student constitutions and ended up deregistering 38 groups that they said were not in compliance. 8 of those were religion-affiliated groups like InterVarsity, which is where a second lawsuit popped up, because InterVarsity joined the Business Leaders in Christ group in suing the university, saying that they were being discriminated against based on religion. So they're both basically accusing each other of discrimination in some form.
Is this particular case, this lawsuit filed against the University of Iowa, is it echoed? Is there anything like this in other instances of higher education in the U.S.? Is this unique?
This is pretty unique, I think, and the group that's litigating it for these two groups, for InterVarsity and Blink, as they call themselves, is the Beckett Religious Liberty Fund, which has been involved in lots of high-profile religion sort of discrimination cases across the country, including the one with Hobby Lobby that made the news and made the way all the way up to the Supreme Court. So it's a pretty high profile case, and I think it is pretty unique. And the U.S. Department of Justice has actually weighed in on the side of the student group, saying that the university is violating the Constitution.
Mm-hmm. So what is expected to happen next Wednesday in U.S. District Court with these two groups?
Yeah. So this is the Business Leaders in Christ group that's facing off with the university, and their jury trial is scheduled for March. So they've had all of these deadlines to file their arguments and their motions, and this is just the portion of those filings that is oral and done in public before a judge. So they get to argue their case before a judge, and what they get to admit during the trial and things like that, so that when they go before an actual jury, they'll, you know, have gotten all of their arguments okayed and all of their documents and everything in line and you know, approved for discussion. So that's kind of what they're going to be talking about. But it will be, I think, a good window into what each is going to portray and then where the judge sort of aligns here. Because if the judge says that's not going to be allowed or that's not, or asks interesting questions, I think we'll, yeah, like I said, we'll get kind of a hint as to where this case is going to go. And I think that if one side sees the writing on the wall, there could be a chance the trial never happens and they settle in some way.
Mm, okay, between the University of Iowa and the student group.
Right.
Is it at all unusual that this would be in March, a jury trial?
I don't know. I don't think that that's terribly unusual. I mean, this is happening at the U.S. District Court level, so it's in Des Moines. It's not a local district court case. You know, it's a federal case, and so I think that they have different timelines, but I don't always see cases like this make it all the way to a jury trial. So I think the fact that if they don't come to some sort of agreement or settlement before then, that will be maybe somewhat unique. And I think whatever happens with this Blink case will probably have implications for the InterVarsity case, which is obviously still pending, and its jury trial is not scheduled until 2020.
So. Mm, okay, so yes, that was my question going forward, whether this case ends up having to be decided by a jury or whether there's a settlement beforehand, potential fallout going forward for other cases that deal with this theme.
Right. Well, I mean, the university has tried to draw a very clear line between this Blink case, the Business Leaders in Christ case, and the InterVarsity case, saying the Business Leaders in Christ case, that was different because that was like a complaint-driven expulsion, basically, as a student group. The InterVarsity case, they're saying, like, starts and ends with the university's review of its 500-plus student group constitutions and its decision to deregister 38. It's saying, we deregistered 38 groups. Not all of them, obviously, were faith-based, and there were lots of other reasons. And so they're saying InterVarsity has no case because InterVarsity can't just jump onto Blink's original case. They have their case starts and ends with their deregistration, you know, following the review. So the university is trying to be very clear and distinct between the two cases. The two groups, I think, are tying their arguments pretty closely together.
Fascinating case. A lot of moving parts here, a lot of ramifications possibly. Vanessa Miller, thank you so much for explaining it to us.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Vanessa Miller is a higher education reporter with the Gazette.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, you ask almost anyone about their childhood and mention snow days, and you'll see a smile as a fond memory pops up, usually. Well, kids around Iowa this week, many of them have been celebrating snow days away from school. Of course, the downside is you may have to make up school days when the weather is balmy, not frigid, as it has been this week. However, one rural Iowa school district is taking a different approach. It's holding virtual snow days when weather forces the district to cancel in-person classes. Joining me to talk about it, Tara Paul, superintendent of Estherville-Lincoln Central Community School District. That's just a few miles from the Minnesota border. Hi, Tara.
Good afternoon.
What are virtual snow days?
Well, virtual snow days are sort of a mixture of a traditional snow day where the kids still get off from school and they can still enjoy being away from school and yet still have some academic time built into their day. You know, we've instilled these this year on a trial basis. We are doing three of them, provided we have three snow days, where kids can connect with their teachers. They have assignments. They don't have to get up at 8:10 and be in their classroom at 8:10. However, they have assignments that they do have to complete. And at the high school, middle school level, teachers may say, hey, we're going to all meet as a class or a small group at 10 o'clock and provide a video conference link or a phone link for them to call in and get connected that way. Otherwise, they're completing these assignments at home. If they don't have Wi-Fi at home, that's not an issue. We have a Google Classroom, and part of the beauty of that setup is kids can still complete the assignments And then when they come to school and they connect to the school Wi-Fi, it uploads and puts those into the classroom as though they've completed that assignment.
So high tech is really helping us out in this situation. Have you had a chance to try out your virtual snow days this week?
Not this week. We had one last Friday. So that was our first virtual day, you know, and with everything in education, you have positives and negatives, and we're collecting some data based on that first day. And right now, our data collection is based on our staff. So what went well compared to what they thought was going to happen? How did it all work out? And they're making some adjustments on that. Once we get through this first set, the first three, if we get there, then we will collect more data from students and the community in terms of what are they liking, what don't they like, how can we make that better for them. But right now we want to get through the first couple just to see what is our pattern of practice, what's actually something that we need to look further into versus an isolated instance that we may not have to deal with at all again.
Okay, so you only have one day, last Friday, in your history of virtual snow days. What are the wrinkles you've identified to work out so far?
You know, one of the things, and it's always a thing with education, is just that communication piece. So we did our very best to prepare kids, and I believe our kids were prepared. We talked to them about it ahead of time. You know, we started on Monday of last week talking about, okay, this is a possibility. Remember what the expectations are, how this is going to work, what you need to do, where your assignments are going to be. But that piece doesn't always get to the home until it becomes a reality. And so we put articles in the newspaper. We did a radio spot about these virtual days, sent letters home. But, you know, like anything, until it actually means something or happens, it kind of gets put on the back burner. And so just getting parents used to that. Also, the understanding that the assignments, especially at, like, K-2 level, are assignments that can go to daycare with students. They can go to grandpa and grandma's house with them. So it's not something they have to be home to do if they have other arrangements for child care on that day. The assignments can be completed anywhere, not just in that home setting.
Mm-hmm. And so they all have the technical equipment at home or with them to make this happen.
Right. And if they don't, then we make some adjustments. So if a student doesn't have Wi-Fi, like I talked about, we have that the Google Classroom, which can be done offline. Our K-2 students, it's not a electronic-based curriculum for the day. Theirs are more activities that can be completed. So they might draw a picture of what it looks like outside at that time and then write a paragraph or write a couple sentences mm-hmm. based on, you know, whatever they're working on. In the third and fourth grade, we are one-to-one during the day, but we don't necessarily send those devices home with kids at night. However, on Thursday, our teachers did send them home, preparing for the fact that it might happen on Friday. So take these home so that you can complete your assignments there. Fifth through 12th grade, we are completely one-to-one, and the students can take their devices home and back. Mm-hmm. And so they have those available to them.
Mm-hmm. So how have the kids, how have the students reacted from what you can tell after one day? I imagine for some, you might have imagined a virtual moan of disappointment across your school district to say, oh,
you know,
no more free days, right?
I have three of them living in my house.
Right. And
so when that came across, they're like, oh, man, a virtual day. However, I think they soon found out it wasn't as bad as what they had anticipated. It wasn't like they were going to go sit in a classroom for 40 minutes like they do on a normal day.
Mm.
And so that quickly went away. You know, you always have some, just like you do in school, that will complete it and some that won't. And so, you know, how do you deal with that? What does that look like on the back end when we come back to school? How do we handle those non-completed assignments? But I think in the end, students realized, okay, this isn't as bad as what we thought it was going to be. And we know we started this process last year with our staff, and we did virtual PD days when the kids had snow days, so that the staff didn't have to come back and make those days up at the end of the year. And during that time, we tried to model for them what we wanted it to look like for kids when we delivered our staff development. And I think that really helps staff to understand that not everything goes perfectly, and when you're at home trying to do work, there are lots of other things going on. So you can't sit for 45 minutes to do one assignment when somebody needs to, you know, watch the younger sibling or the phone rings, you know, or something within the home has to be done. So that mentality really helped us prepare for kids and understanding they're not going to just be sitting there with nothing else going on in the house. So how do we chunk that for them? How do we help them manage their time and be productive that day?
And this sort of virtual snow day, it has to fulfill state requirements counting for a school day, right, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So we can't count our virtual days against our 1,080 hours that are mandated by the state legislators. So we are over our hours, and so we're able to do these virtual days. And it comes in a discrepancy between our students are on hours and our teachers are on days. Our schedule allows us some flex time in terms of that 1,080, but our teacher contract doesn't.
Mm.
Last year, one of the biggest feedbacks that we got from our staff was they were missing valuable academic time. Although they were learning and getting their professional development needs met, they were still missing academic time with the kids, and they wanted that back to some extent, which then led us into the student virtual days so that they could get some of that time back and not lose all that academic time. One of the differences with these virtual days, though, is it's not the teachers aren't going to give new content delivery on these days. It will either be an introduction to new content that will happen in a face-to-face, or it'll be a practice of something that they've learned, a reinforcement of something, or an extended learning opportunity from what they've already learned. So I think that was one of the biggest rumors that we had to dispel right away is teachers aren't going to sit down and teach a new mathematical concept when the kids are at home.
Right.
They will get that when they come back so that the teacher can have that one-to-one interaction with kids to see, okay, are they really understanding it? What misconceptions? I mean, there's still a lot of value in that face-to-face contact with teachers.
Tara, before we say goodbye, where did you get the idea for these virtual snow days? Has anybody else been trying it out that you know of?
You know, I'm not sure. I did a lot of research with schools to the north of us in Minnesota who have been implementing this, but also from the feedback that we got from our staff last year and how do we meet the needs of kids, meet the standards of the 1,080 hours, but still fulfill our academic needs on these snow days. And so that's kind of where we developed it. We have a DLT or a district leadership team that has helped to create this idea even further at the different building levels. So the expectations aren't the same across the district, just like they aren't on a day-to-day basis here. We don't expect the same thing from a kindergartner that we do from a senior. And so how does that play out within the building?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just been a lot of planning and a lot of discussing internally for us.
Mm. Well, Tara Paul, this is interesting. We wish you good luck with your virtual snow days or virtual cold days, I guess you say, because some of the days it isn't because of snow that we can't come. It's because it's so darn cold. And when I look at the forecast for next week, it looks like we have a couple days where we won't get above 0 degrees in actual temperature. So you may be looking at virtual snow days, cold days next week, huh?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's another opportunity for us to gather some data and make ourselves better.
Okay. Tara Paul, superintendent of Esterville-Lincoln Central Community School District, just a few miles away from the Minnesota border. Tara Paul, thanks for sharing with us.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
That does it for this edition of River to River. Governor Kim Reynolds has proposed a constitutional amendment that would allow felons in Iowa to vote after completing their prison sentences, probation, and parole. We'll talk about that Monday on this program after we get through the weekend. Before we go into the weekend, we certainly have to groove into the weekend with Tony Daynor, IPR Studio One Tracks host. Hi, Tony.
Hey, Ben.
It's awful cold out there. You got
it
something
is.
To fire us up and get us into the weekend and keep us with Studio One in the weekend.
I do. The post holiday thaw in new releases is over. We're finally getting some new music into the library, including this one that's out today. This guy's name is Steve Gunn. He's a Pennsylvania-based singer-songwriter. Also has worked as a sideman with a couple of our favorites, Kurt Vile and His Golden Messenger. This new record from Steve Gunn is called The Unseen and Between. It's his 15th album, and this is Vagabond.
Okay, Tony Daynor of IPR Studio One, thanks so much.
Thanks, Ben.
River to River is produced by Caitlin Harrop, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, wishing you a wonderful and warm weekend. Until Monday.